Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And this podcast is brought to you by GoToMeeting. And if you're not using a web conferencing tool or a service that you're using now is, well, kind of clunky, use my first choice, GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is really easy to use. It turns a call into an instant online meeting in just one click. It's affordable, very secure, and it substantially reduces your meeting-related expenses. I got to tell you something. This is really neat because you can have voice over IP included, call in via the phone on your computer or just by using a phone. And you can try GoToMeeting for free for 30 days. But you must visit gotomeeting.com/podcast for that free trial. Again, that's gotomeeting.com/podcast for your free 30-day trial. And a good morning, good afternoon, good evening to you. How are you? It's Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Episode number 163, we're at the end of May, finishing up that old sell in May and go away concept, and boy, oh boy, it was right this month. We'll talk a little bit about markets, we're going to talk about some of the issues that are concerning the economics around the world today, and I've been so horrible at telling you some of the guests that were coming up that after last show, last week, when I just couldn't bring any of the names to the front of my brain that obviously got soft by the end of that episode, I thought what I would do is start with some of the names of some of the people coming up. We have Kate Stalter from Investors Business Daily. She's one of the lead writers, and she's going to be coming up in a couple of weeks. We got Charles Kirk from The Kirk Report. I've been chasing him around for the last 2 years, and I hopefully convince him to come on the show. Fausto Puglisi, Cyber Trading University, is also going to be on in the next few weeks. And today we have a special guest. John Najarian from Options Monster is going to be joining us, and I have a lot to talk to him about. We talk a good bit, but I wanted to ask him some specific things. I know you had a lot of questions about what was going on in the markets, where were the opportunities right now, what's happening not only in the area of options, but also in the area of trading. So we're going to talk about all this today as we wrap up the month of May and head into the summer. I hope you have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend, or had a Memorial Day weekend that was very memorable, and that you're ready to move on and get a little bit of a kind of a little pause that refreshes, so to speak. So what happened? Where are we? What went on? Last week, it appears that everything was just, one day things were bad, the next day they were worse, then all of a sudden there was hope for a little bit of a reprieve, and then on Thursday, it seemed like everything was just healed. A magic little potion was poured, a sprinkle of fairy dust over the stock markets were let out of the sky, and all of a sudden things were fine. Let's think about it, right? What do we have happen? We had Spain had an austerity plan that passed. Oil, it seems like the top kill maybe worked, and the oil spill was going to stop. The volcano seemed to stop blowing its top. Greece was getting a little bit in better shape. The riots had been calming down a little bit. They passed their austerity measures. Their bonds are flowing in terms of with the backing, of course. The financial regulation bill, the passage of that may show a lot less stringent requirements on the financial firms. And in addition to that, they may be pulling out the Lincoln Amendment, which calls for a heavier oversight on derivatives trading. North and South Korea are not making nicey-nice yet, but at the same time, diplomatic methods are going to be used, so it seems right now, to do something about the concept of North Korea essentially sinking a South Korean vessel. And then to the rescue, like the wonderful country that it has been for the last year and a half, helping to solve all the problems around the world, from the recovery and the start of the recovery to the continuation of the stabilization of the world markets, to now ensuring that, at least from their mouth, that they said that they will continue to back the European bond buying and the euro because they're a big trading partner. As a matter of fact, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 27% of the trading that China gets is from Europe. So for them to stop actually buying their bonds and their debt and to pull the euro would be pretty much an economic death sentence for them. So they're not going to do that. But at the same time, when we look at what's really going on behind the scenes, will really tell us in the next few weeks what's going on. The euro popped up towards about 124.5, came back down a bit right before the Chinese announced that they were going to hold and do well. And there was another announcement, I think, by, was it Kuwait or was it Arab Emirates? There was some Middle Eastern region that announced they were also standing behind the euro. But right before that, we dipped down and touched the low that we saw, the 121 and change. I think it was 121.33 or so. And then it bounced right off of there and started flying up higher. There's a lot of bets still against the euro right now. There's a lot of bets that there's going to be this continued problem in the region because it's going to show a lot of slowing, and possibly this economic austerity measures that will be put in are almost like a forced recession, kind of like a forced double dip in the region. There's a lot of companies in the United States have been talking about the potential of the EPS that may take a hit on that, but wait to be seen. But Thursday was one of those days that really put a lot of vigor back in the markets, except for one issue. The volume, again, wasn't there. We are continuing to see this trend where volume has been very light on the up days, and a 3.5% up day or 3.25% up day on the S&P 500, almost 4% on the NASDAQ, small caps rallied. That's a big concern. The concern is that a lot more institutional and hedge fund selling than there is buying in this environment right now. Something to just be cautious about. We don't want to buy the market at the lowest point ever and call the bottom. And, you know, everybody gets the accolades for doing so. Now, Doug Kass talked about, oh, the bottom's here. Barton Biggs said, you know what? This market's ready to pop any day. And, you know, they'll get this great credit that they had that wonderful day a few days later. Of course, just beforehand, the market was down. But nonetheless, when we look at the market, and we have to look at not only the market involved here, but the reflection on what it says about the global environment. Just take as an example what happened this week when it came to the economics in the United States. And I got to tell you something. They have been really good for a while. They have been involved in the stabilization recovery or recovery and stabilization process for a while. But this week we saw durables that disappointed. Jobless claims, in my opinion, over 460 and change, disappointed. We saw the Chicago Purchasing Managers light and their employment index was light. University of Michigan sentiment was right on the consumer sentiment that we saw earlier in the week on Tuesday from the conference board was actually looking a lot better. Personal spending came in light, and we also saw that Japan, while exports were up for a fifth consecutive month, their unemployment rate surprisingly and unexpectedly went to 5.4%, and prices continued to decline by 1.5% again this month. And that is the continuation of the deflationary story. We've talked about this before, that inflation is just not present right now. And the good news of that is that Bernanke and the Fed are able to keep their foot on the pedal. And with the European situation that we've been seeing right now, we don't think there's any reason that they're going to pull the pedal off. They're not going to put that brake on, at least. They may lighten up on their, you know, pushing the foot down the floor on the pedal, but they're not putting the brake on for a while. Inflation is clearly not showing up from what we saw in the CPI numbers and the PPI numbers last week. Could we be having a bottom right now and the scares are over? Until what? Till the next thing crops up? Till the next riots that show up? Till North Korea and South Korea start getting into a fight again? Till oil prices spike again? Which brings me to the discussion of oil prices. You know, here's something really fascinating. This year we saw oil go from about 87 down to about 67 or so, about a 20% reduction in the price of oil. A lot of people who are very bullish say, hey, that's really good. That's good because that helps the consumer. It puts more money in your pocket. I agree. It's kind of like taking away a gasoline tax that you have to pay every single day. At the same time, though, I want you to consider that the price at the pump, we just calculated this. I'm going to put a chart on the show notes at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I want you to take a look at. The prices of gasoline at the pump are only down from the top to the bottom 10%. Now, maybe there's a little bit of a lag factor there that we have to look at, but I got to tell you something. The lag is usually not there when oil prices move up. Have you noticed this? Watch as oil prices go up and down and watch the prices at the pump. Again, it's just, you know, a little anecdotal information from what you're looking at, where you are. But it's very interesting to find that they're much faster to move up prices than they are down. All right, with all that as a preface, as a precursor to a discussion that we'll have with John Najarian, because I'm sure he's going to have a lot to say about many of these topics, let's kind of take a break. We'll do a little musical interlude like we do, getting ready the studio for our discussion with John Najarian. And then we come back after I finish that. We're going to have a comment from a listener. Demarius comments on something that Harry Dent recently said, and it has a question that I'm going to actually answer. I think you'll find it of interest. So stick around. Also, by the way, before we take the break, do me a favor. If you're kind of worried about the markets and concerned about what's going on, not, you know, you're on the fence. Do you want to invest? Do you want to short? Do you want to go long? What do you want to do? If you don't have the conviction to do it yourself, I give you the opportunity and I'm giving you the encouragement to check out what we're doing over at The Disciplined Investor. You know, we have the strategy that we talk about. If you listen to DH Unplugged, a lot of the stocks that we talk about there are oftentimes in our portfolio. And, you know, you can take a look at the way we manage money, and maybe it's something that you're really ready for at this point. There's a 14-minute virtual tour that you want to check out over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll put a link in this week's show notes so you can check that out. And just, you know, for whatever it's worth, if you haven't done so already, go check it out. You'll just see what's going on and see about the information. And maybe it's right for you, and, you know, maybe it's not. But at least you checked it out. You gave yourself that opportunity. So stick around. We'll be right back with John Najarian, the doc from Options Monster, right here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All right, we are here back with a good friend of mine, John Najarian. You know him from Options Monster. You see him quite often, and his brother, on CNBC's After Hours market wrap called what is it called?
Fast Money.
Fast Money, of course. How can I forget that?
Fast Money.
Truth be known, my friend. Honestly, all kidding aside, that's my favorite show.
Oh, thank you.
Do you know
You're
why?
Very kind to
do
say
know,
that,
do,
Andrew.
Do you know why that is? It's because I don't have to listen to the dribble of people who think that they know markets reading off a prompter. I can get somebody who's been in that. No, really. But somebody who's been in it and watching it and understands it, knows it. And not only that, is doing it actually with the involved with the process rather than just kind of commenting. I think it's a very important thing to understand the whole game is to be a part of it.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Thank you. It's a fun show to do,
yeah.
And it's a lot like those ESPN shows, and it was meant to be from the very beginning like that, where you've got a bunch of folks that were either former pro football players and or coaches talking about, along with sports writers, about what went on in the game that day. And in this case, of course, it's a game a lot of us play every day, but then investors look at usually when their 401k is not doing so well, and that is the stock market, and they get more interested, more concerned when the markets aren't going well, even more so than when the markets are going well.
Yeah, you want to hear something interesting? There's a great way to prove that. It's very simple, and that is that I can see that when markets aren't doing well, my podcast goes up the charts and my book sales go up dramatically. When markets are doing really well, it's kind of like it starts to just, you know, stay in the middle somewhere.
Yeah, and that it does make some sense, though, because, of course, if we were to reverse that, Andrew, and say, well, when your sports team is not doing well, then people basically lose any interest in following it because, you know, who wants to follow a bunch of losers? But since we have investments in
right,
the market,
right,
and very few of us own sports teams, it's kind of the polar opposite for us. When the markets get a little dicey, that's when they look to a pro like you and hopefully to people like me to help them out.
Right.
And that's when they get even more interested rather than less interested.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the Options Monster Conference in a little while, but we're going to make you work for your plug here, okay? How's that?
That's fine.
So there's lots going on, and we can talk about so many different things. I mean, obviously, in center of the world, it seems, in the last week or so, has been the the euro issue, clearly, and the concern over what's happening there, how fast the moves have been on the euro. I mean, I talk about this a lot, that in the old days, quote-unquote old days, you know, black and white TV days, a one-penny move on a currency differential was a lot. 1% move, let's even say, was a lot. You know, we're seeing 2 and 3% moves on a daily basis on currencies. I mean, that's abnormal, right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's the polar opposite of normal. We usually see that as being a much more stable market, volatilities in the single digits, and all of a sudden out of nowhere, because of the potential that Greece causes the European Union to not so much break apart, Andrew, because, boy, I certainly don't see that, but I do see a possibility of them kicking out a certain number of those pigs, you know, whether it's Portugal, Italy, not so much Italy, I guess, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. There's the potential that one or more of those could be forced out because they can't get their debt under control. And if that's the case, that's probably a good thing that they do, push them aside and then let them loosen up their own currency, whether it's Greece with drachma or whatever, to get things back in line. And that would allow them to do it much more so than being part of the European Union would.
Yeah, but that's all great on paper, I think. But the aftershocks of that and the timing, you know, there's a timeline that would have to take to happen. And the time when it would take where there was a decision made that Greece would be out of the euro, and then the shock waves that would be sent through, and also the disassociation with the different banking and crossover businesses and the currency issues, it's a lot easier to talk about, I think, than actually doing. It's kind of like, you know, a surgery where, you know, it says, oh, it's easy just to transplant this liver to this guy, but, you know, it takes a lot of work to get there.
Yep, and that's very true. And we certainly, being people, you and I both, that have significant investments for ourselves and others in the markets, I'd rather not see Europe break apart right now. I'd rather see them be what they are, and that is a trading partner and an active participant both in capital markets and in the buying and selling of goods back and forth. And to the extent that they do that, and they do so at a better price to them because they're together, if that pulled apart, that would be potentially, I guess, short-term anyway, good for us, but longer-term, I don't think it is.
Yeah, I hear you. So there's a couple of things I want to talk to you about. The fair market accounting rules I've been talking about, FASB is talking about doing fair market accounting. Now, if everybody remembers, one of the things that took us out of the free fall in the banking industry was FASB came up with a way to do mark-to-market so that we would hide all of the bad debt so that we wouldn't see it and think about it anymore, so nobody thinks there's any problems. I mean, that's my definition of it. And now they're coming up. Am I wrong on that?
Nope, I don't think you are. but I think they tightened it up too fast on them, Andrew, when, of course, in 08, they hit them with this and they had to put it in, those new accounting standards. And all of a sudden, like you say, the fair accounting really became something that was rather unfair, not because they were just bad guys and they'd always been hiding things, but because they didn't have enough time to get their house in order before they had to start taking marks on stuff, and they took them right at the worst possible time, of course.
Right. So now they're going, is this a 180-degree turn backward, or is this some kind of a quasi-plan, a hybrid plan from what they're going to do? Because I think there's still a lot of bad debt, I think we all know this, on the books of many of the major banks, and how much is it going to hurt them? And then we have to get into the whole discussion, of course, of, you know, the rating agencies. What are they going to think about this?
Yep. Well, and boy, those rating agencies. Yesterday we were talking about the Iris Sohn conference in New York. And that particular conference, folks, if you don't follow it as closely as Andrew and I do, that's a great conference. It benefits kids with various pediatric diseases and things like that. So it's a charitable event, but they get the best of the best. They get, you know, the Einhorns and the Ackmans and the Sam Zells speaking at this for 15 minutes apiece. What is their single best idea? And one of those best ideas, Andrew, it was either Ackman or Einhorn. I can't remember but it was selling a Moody's, the rating agency. I couldn't agree more. These guys have blood on their hands. I thought it was a terrible miscarriage of business practice, as well as probably close to some fraud here, that you're taking money for rating various bonds and things and not even taking a good hard look at those bonds.
Well, it's the old,
at least that's what it looks like.
Yeah, it's all the, you know, it's the who's watching the hen house. I mean, you know, you can't let the wolves and those that are going to be involved. It's just not a good thing to do. I mean, the whole area of ratings agencies, the unfortunate bias that comes along with the conflict of interest when they're taking money to do so, and then if they don't give the right ratings, they're not going to get the business again. It's just a terrible conflict of interest. And it's very interesting that Bloomberg just recently hopped into the fray. Did you see that?
Yes, I did.
That's interesting. I thought that was a really interesting thing when the government is coming out with the notion that they want to have a centralized or at least a pooled rating process for municipals. All of a sudden, Bloomberg, who is highly respected and has all the data, by the way, can actually come in there and do some work on that. So we'll see what that happens, what goes on with that. But the other question is, you know, did the rating agencies move too fast on some of this European situation, or maybe not, trying to save their tuchuses because they were so slow on everything else?
Yeah, and I think the answer to that is an easy answer. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's exactly right. They did not cover themselves with much honor with what they had done rating those bonds that were famously packaged in The Big Short, Michael Lewis's book, and so forth, and instead are perhaps being a little harsher with the justice that they met out for those European derivatives. And I think if they looked at the same through those same glasses, Andrew, at the U.S. derivatives they were rating, I think these problems would not have been as big if these guys hadn't given it the AAA rating.
Right. So, did you read The Big Short? Was it good?
I did. Loved it.
I got to get that book. I heard it was very
Oh,
very good.
Yeah. In fact, folks, if you're lazy or if you just travel a lot or you're jogging or on your walks, it's a great book to listen to on the Audible version. Amazon.com has it, and I love listening to audio books that way as well. Like I say, because I'm spending half my life on planes, it's pretty convenient.
Hey, if they were sponsoring this particular episode, that would have been great. But
well, we'll both have to talk to them about
exactly.
that. They should be sponsoring
exactly.
this.
Well,
podcast.
They usually do, but lately they've got other plans, I guess. What is on the desk? I got to tell you, every day when I watch, let me be fair. I don't watch Fast Money every day, but it's on a little bit early for me. It's on at 5. It used to be on at 11 or so as a replay, but I don't think they do that anymore, or 12 or something. But almost every day, the fascination and almost fetish with the desk, with Goldman Sachs, there is so, how many stocks that are out there and how many financials are out there? I mean, nobody talks about J.P. Morgan as much as they talk about Goldman Sachs. It's almost kind of weird how much this desk talks about Goldman Sachs. Can you explain that?
Well, I can do part of it. I'm one of those guys who's fascinated with it because I worked for them for a lot of years, for 10 years or more. I worked at Goldman. I think Guy Adami also worked there, my brother Pete. So there's somewhat of a prejudice just because we worked with them so much. But also, when I look at it, Andrew, and I say, you're getting in at the price that Warren Buffett got in at. Warren Buffett, of course, famously bailed him out in September of 2008, right after Lehman, as the stuff was hitting the fan. He gave him billions of dollars. He got preferred shares, and then he got a second tranche of a like amount that he could exercise into stock 10% below that 125 level where he got in, down around 115 or so.
And by the way, John, this is after he swore he would never do so when he got burned on the deal with that bond house. What bond house was that? It wasn't Shearson. It was another bond house. Oh, I can't remember the name.
Solomon Brothers.
Solomon, yeah. We got that, and he wouldn't do it. All right, so let's just set this up. So now he's in this deal, and he got it at a very low price. He got an amazing interest rate. Which, by the way, let's also say that Goldman says they never needed the money. But okay, put that aside for a second. He got a tremendous interest rate, and I believe it's callable by Goldman at par, whatever it is. But he did very well on those investments.
Yep, but like you say, it's not a perpetual warrant. It is callable by them, but it's callable at a huge premium.
Okay.
In other words, I think they would have to pay him in the neighborhood of 120% of basically to get out, and until then they have to continue to pay him on the preferred a 10% dividend, just like Andrew said, folks, for owning Goldman Sachs and making a 10% dividend. That's a pretty neat trick.
So kind of this is Buffett's version of white collar loan sharking.
It is, but they came to him.
I understand.
It's not like he went to them to pitch
with you.
It. In fact,
I'm with you.
They even, according to both The Big Short and Sorkin's book, Too Big to Fail, they went to him in Omaha because he's like, I'm not traveling to New York.
Nice.
You want to pitch me the deal? Pitch me.
Nice.
And they came to Omaha, pitched him the deal, and he said, okay, under those terms, I'll do that. Anyway, so let's say he owns it at 125, and again, he owns another tranche at about 115. Goldman got down to 134 on Monday this week and then turned and burned to the upside.
Right.
So you could have certainly done a number of option strategies, folks. that would have got you in at that level that Warren Buffett owned the stock. You could have also just sold some puts down around the 125 strike with the stock trading 135. You could have made a lot of money really fast on this rebound. But I think, Andrew, you're right, that we shouldn't just look at a Goldman Sachs, not when there's Jefferies, JEF, the symbol there, or Deutsche Bank, DB. I mean, there's so many. You decide the size you want.
Yeah, you got JP, you got Wells Fargo, you got all in the same area. I mean, and then obviously the secondary fascination with Citi. I mean, the problem with Citi is it's a tradable stock. It's just, you know, nobody knows what's really going on there. That's the problem there.
Yeah.
But the other thing about,
and there's still that overhang of all those billions of dollars shares of stock the government owns.
So the other thing about Goldman, though, that I thought was interesting was that the amount of money that he had Buffett has, which obviously going to help him, or it's going to help the stock in that he's going to defend it somehow, whether it's by maybe buying more or by at least saying things. As a matter of fact, this was almost too ironic to be real, but just a few days before the fraud charges were placed, did you see that? That Buffett talked about how they gave money to Goldman, not only due to the investment, because the integrity of the management. And then, voila, a couple days later, the fraud charges come out.
Yep. And then he came out the week after that, Andrew, and defended him when he said, because he came out, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, and he said who the bad players were. And he named Dick Fuld over at Lehman, not Lloyd Blankfein over at Goldman, and that surprised a lot of folks. They expected him to come out firing on Goldman. Those people don't know Warren Buffett as well as you and I know him. He's not going to cut off his nose to spite his face. He has a multi-billion-dollar investment there. He's not going to queer that investment.
Right. Now, Fold, I don't know if he was working at CIT at the time. I can't believe he actually got another job, but that's a whole different discussion for a different different thing. So what do you like right now? I mean, right now the market is in either one of two things. It's in a corrective cycle that's more long-term, leading to a bear in the U.S. I'm talking about, or as I view it, as a correction and maybe deeper in some regards than a normal correction that you would have, but maybe not, in a bullish market, an ongoing bullish rally, whether that's, you know, could be correcting a little bit more, it could be moving up a little bit more. There's a lot of resistant points, a lot of people that are, you know, shaking their heads again, saying, hey, this time is different, like they did in July, like they did in February. But we did see some very different characteristics of the market this time around than we did before. The volatility, and forget about the flash crash, that's a whole different discussion. But do you still see this, and I know you're pretty bullish, but do you still see this generally as a correction in a bull trend or something that's a little bit bigger that may actually be more of a sideways to down market trend?
I think we could easily get there, Andrew. I think the thing that stops us perhaps from getting to the sideways to down is the closer we get to the fall, the more clarity we'll have on how well the Tea Party group will do in terms of keeping control away from the president, because his policies have not been popular with investors, the president that is, and to the extent that they rein in some of the power that right now he has, nearly unlimited power with both houses of Congress on his side, even though he hasn't been able to even get his own party to walk the plank and make some of these moves that the Tea Party in particular has highlighted as bad for America. I think to the extent that you see the Tea Party gaining momentum into the fall, which events like the flash crash, like the oil spill, like bailing out of all these institutions, this plays right into the hands of the Tea Party and into the people running against the incumbents. I think to the extent that you keep those same incumbents out of the office as much as possible, I think the market rallies on that rather than sells off. So, like I say, I'll give you the pivot point right there for if it looks like it's going to be business as usual, then we go down. I think if it looks like we're going to throw out a bunch of the bums and start over, I think the market rallies.
Yeah. So the other thing is that there is this potential overhang. You know, this week we saw GDP come out. And by the way, by all accounts, I got to tell you something, that was disappointing. 3.0 was the print just a couple of days before. Goldman Sachs came up with a 3.7 as their survey that they estimated, up from about 3.5. The survey was somewhere about 3.4 to 3.6, depending on where you looked. By all accounts, that was bad. We're still seeing a high number of initial claims. And by the way, just as a side note, when I see initial claims up, when I see the unemployment rate up, I've decided that's good for the market. As crazy as that sounds, short term.
I don't think you're wrong. I think you're right.
I mean, I think that the general notion that we have to have a lot of employment and a lot of people working is obviously key to a long-term sustainable economy. But in the interim, it seems like if we right now seem to see a really big gain in payrolls. By the way, we're looking at possibly a 500,000 print next week. And that's going to be a lot of census workers, of course. But that's what the current numbers are looking like. And I think that that's going to rally the retail investors saying, hey, this job's coming back and things are good. And, well, some are census, some are not. But I think the reality is the institutions don't want to see a lot of employment back because the reason why companies are doing so well is the cost cutting they've done with the human capital.
Yep. You know? The extent that they can stretch that further, to the extent that technology companies have allowed them to do more with the same amount without having to bring on additional people, while that's bad for the people that are out of work, it certainly helps you make money when you're that company. So if you're investing in the companies, that is one of the things that you and I, Andrew, have focused on, is that the productivity is at record highs. Mm-hmm. And while I'd love to see job creation, I think many of these companies that you and I are investing in would probably see a bit of a pullback if they started to do that.
Did I ever share my article that I wrote about consumption cannibalism? Did I ever send
it
to you?
I'd love to get it.
My theory is this. My theory is that whatever date you want to use, but let's just say the 90s, okay? This whole re-engineering process happened, and people were doing a lot of things to be more efficient, and companies needed to do this, et cetera, okay? This is the condensed version. But then technology came along in such a way that companies embraced it to do a lot of things and to replace a lot of the human repetitive nature of what they did. Just think of word processing, file management, you know, digital scanning, archival, just those kind of things. And then go even further with robotics and CAD designing on the computer. And then even go even further than that with just-in-time manufacturing processes. All these things come together, and in a way, they're fascinating. They're tremendous. They create so much more productivity, efficiency, profit centers, and all this. But in the end, if you really take this longer and go out on the edge of all of this, it's kind of like the rise of the machines in a way. And that, you know, you question, not that machines are going to do anything weird like start a nuclear war, I'm not saying that, but what it does say to me is that the machines, the technology that we embrace is replacing human beings, and those people need to eat, drink, sleep, and another S, and, you know, shower, that's what it was.
That was what I was thinking.
Yeah. So, no, seriously, that in the end, do we, you know, how do we get back to a point where we actually are producing the amount that we need to, that equilibrium to make the economy sustainable? And is it possible, aside from the whole bad loan thing that went on, is it possible that we are in for a new normal like O'Reilly? What's his name? Muhammad
O'Reilly?
No, O'Reilly.
Bill O'Reilly?
No. Mm-hmm. Muhammad.
Oh, Kudlow?
Yeah, Kudlow, too. Yeah, he says that, too. No, the guy at PIMCO, Muhammad O'Reilly.
El Arian,
thank you. I don't know. I couldn't get that out. But he says the new, you know, they're talking about the new normal. Is this going to be the new normal that we're going to look at? And if so, it's good for the markets for a while. But if we don't see any top line revenue growth, where do we go?
Yeah, and it's overall, it's very disconcerting and potentially, I guess, very bad for folks that then are not skilled laborers. Skilled labor always, by its very nature, exacts a better payment for the hours worked than does just a strong back.
Right.
And yet, we do need jobs for folks that do just have strong backs and really don't have strong minds. And that's not to demonize folks that didn't get the same opportunities that you and I had, Andrew.
I fit both of those categories, by the way.
but, I mean, it is a fact. People need jobs. They feel better self-worth when they are working. And so, you know, as much as people demonize unions from time to time, I want folks to be working in productive jobs that they're happy with and that they can, you know, see a light at the end of the tunnel in terms of saving for their retirement and all the rest. Problem is that I see fewer and fewer of those strong back jobs, and the competition for the big brain jobs gets tougher and tougher as well. At least we're still able to compete in that area, but the folks that find themselves, you know, not working at a GM plant anymore, there are fewer choices unless they make big moves and big career moves in terms of reinvesting in themselves and going back to school and so forth.
Right.
That's tough to do when you're 50 years old.
I hear you. I'm going to throw out my favorite, like if I was to kind of be held down and said, Andrew, what areas, what sectors, what stocks, what do you like, you know, what do you got that feeling for? What looks really good? Not so much necessarily only on paper or chart, I'm saying, but, you know, conceptually, the overall picture of everything. And then I want you to do the same. Then we're going to talk about the Options Monster conference and a little bit about Options Monster. So here's what I'm thinking. I mean, I've done a lot of work at looking at the whole idea that states are, well, essentially bankrupt, looking for money any way they can. They can't really raise property taxes. You know, they can't raise taxes on their citizens. And they're just having all sorts of major problems with their budgets. And not that that's not their fault. It is. But they have to figure out different ways and be more creative to bring in capital. And been doing it to their floating bonds, and they're doing it at lower rates when things come in. So that's helping. The idea that many of these areas are going to open, many of the states are opening up the casino gaming, to the people in their state and putting their, I guess, morals and ethics that they always had, and those they stood on a pedestal and said, no, there's no gaming here. Leave it in Vegas. Leave it in Mississippi. Leave it in, leave it in New Jersey. We don't want it here. Well, that's all changing. We just saw New Hampshire is going through some things. We saw Maryland, Massachusetts. There's probably like 10 or 12 states that all have something on the books to look at that. What I like is the first thing they're going to probably put in, and that is the slot machines. You know, companies like WMS Gaming, I've been talking about for a while, BYI, which is Bally's, and IGT as an example, I think are going to be a great play. Now, that's aside from the fact of what you want to talk about the casinos themselves, right? What do you like? You like
those are great picks, by the way.
I love them.
I like WMS a lot.
Yeah, good stock, good company. And they just got orders for about 3,500 machines from Italy just recently. And I'm trying to find the piece that Jani wrote just today or yesterday or a couple days ago. They're looking at about, you know, in, I want to say it's New Hampshire, but I'm not remembering if it's New Hampshire right now off the top of my head. They just approved that they could put machines in the truck stops, as well as a variety of other places around. They're talking about possibly another 10,000 machines that are going to be needed for that space. There's only a few companies that really are involved in that.
Yep.
So I think that's kind of
right. And it is a true cash cow, because in many cases, especially with the financing being tighter and tougher to come by, the way that these companies are moving those slots out there, folks, is they're getting a part of the take from the machine as part of the financing.
Right.
So in other words, WMS or ShuffleMaster, IGT, Bally's, they'll finance the machine for the casinos for a percentage of the take, and that's a much better deal for them, rather, because they're able to continue to move the stuff through the factory, of course, not just build inventory up, and then they have something out there working for them, making money, because, like I say, they're taking part of the handle on that amount of money gone through that machine.
Right. This was actually in Illinois. They passed it, or was ready to pass it, and they were passing some things. 30,000 possible machines if it passes. 2,100 machines and slots if the full legislation goes through all throughout all the counties. And they only say that it's going to be negative possibly to Penn National, which is obviously a casino, which will get less. My second choice is there's going to be a lot of fallout due to this whole offshore drilling issue. I mean, I don't know. If you ask me to approve an offshore drilling rig, you know, that would be a tough thing if I was in charge, right? I mean, with what's going on. So we need oil. And the whole game has been, you know what, we want to be less dependent on, you know, nations that are not friendly to us, less dependent on anyone else but ourselves. The inland drillers of both natural gas and of oil, two companies that we've chosen, actually, one of them is, which changing their name today, to St. Mary's Oil and Gas, SM.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one, they're changing it to SM Energy, I think they're calling it. Big name change. They just announced it a couple days ago. The second one is Concho Resources. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, CXO.
I am not familiar with that one, but I like it.
Yeah, I mean, this concept is these guys are drilling, inland. And to me, it's a lot easier to cap off a well that's right on the top of the ground, whatever you have to do, rather than 5,000 feet down. And their books look great. Their stock charts are a mess like everybody else's right now. Because of what's happened over the last few weeks. But generally speaking, these are companies, and St. Mary's I like a lot. These are just cleanly, well-run companies with good balance sheets, good production numbers, wells that are running and coming up and just doing a tremendous job in a variety of different areas. Both for one has a little bit more of a natural gas bent to it, and that's natural gas. We got to question what's going on with that. But and then the oil side. So anytime you're going to see a pop in oil prices, you're going to see something good. Those are my kind of areas that are just like in the love of my life right now in terms of the companies that I like and companies.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I won't like them at all if they go against me. We'll cut them. But nonetheless, like any trader would, right? Love them as long as they love you. That's what I always say.
Well, I'm in two of the stocks that are in the space you're talking about, Andrew. I'm in Sandridge Energy. It's a $6 stock. SD is the symbol there. It's just off the 52-week lows. Like I say, $6 stock, been as high as 15. A lot of buying lately we've seen in the options of that stock, Sandridge Energy. And again, it's one of those where it's not a deep-sea driller. I'm also in HK, like Petrohawk Energy, HK like Hunter Killer, the submarines. But this one, HK Petrohawk, interesting play. The stock has been moving up steadily. There are, of course, the ubiquitous takeover rumors. I don't think you buy it for that reason, but I think Petrohawk, when you look at the longer-term charts and things like that, and you see, okay, just recently, the recent chart is end of April, the stock was $23. Here it is, you're picking it up at $18.70 or give or take today. You know, I think stocks like that have a lot of potential. I did already make some scalps in BP on this top fill kill or whatever they're calling it.
That's the only play to do is scalps, because who knows what the long-term ramifications are going to be from this.
Exactly. And for that reason, I think... there are other stocks. I mean, if you want to be in the energy spaces, I think you just described, Andrew, the sorts of stocks that are going to make the most sense. Natural gas, and in particular, land drillers, not the ones that are out there having to go into the deep water, because maybe a lot of that gets cut back, except for like examination and inspection of existing platforms.
Yep. So let's talk a little bit about the Options Monster. Optionsmonster.com is where, which of course, John started with, I believe, with your brother. And you're having a conference, I believe, in Chicago in June. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, we got to get you to the next couple we do. I think we're going to be in Dallas and Atlanta later in the year. But right now, we're June 25th and 26th. If people go to investlikeamonster.com, you'll see that we've got the editor of Barron's, Mike Santoli. We've got
I just talked to him today. Isn't that weird?
Oh, he's the best.
Yeah.
love him. My brother, Pete, Guy Adami from Fast Money as well. I'll be there. We've got a real good lineup. It's $199, so it's not like we've got our hand real deep in people's pockets. They get lunch and snacks as well as some refreshments throughout the day. So that is about a third of the cost of it, believe it or not, Andrew, just paying for the food and drink for everybody.
Yep.
So you can get the idea that this isn't a situation where we're trying to put our hand really deep into your pocket
right,
to extract as much money as we can. But we're hoping, of course, that people that learn end up trading on the Trade Monster platform at some point, because we also own that brokerage firm.
Right. So I'm going to put a link on the show notes to this show on it, so people can check it out and what it's all about and who's speaking and all that. I have a question on the show, the Fast Money show, for a moment. There was a gentleman on there for a while. First of all, thank you for clearing up the word Guy Adami, because there's a lot of people who call him Guy. I don't know what that's all about.
I don't know why it started, but now we all sort of nickname him Guy. You're right.
Yeah,
but I don't know why.
What happened to Mackey? Is he still around?
No, he is still around, thankfully. Yep, and he still works over at Minionville.
Uh-huh.
Bright guy, very fun guy, but had disagreements with the leadership of CNBC, and so for that reason, they invited him not to come back.
Yeah, I got to talk to that guy. I think what happened, this is totally, you don't have to respond to this, but there was that time when things were so heated and going on with the banks and all that and the disgust that was going on. There was a lot of play, like a Dylan Ratigan, and as a matter of fact, on the same desk with him at the time. Dylan has his own show, which is pretty much just blast the establishment, blast the banks.
Yep.
That's his show. I don't think there's anything else to it. That's pretty much the show title for every episode, I think. and I think that, it got to a point for all of us. We were all scratching our head going, like, what is going on? I mean, who is not only running this thing, but how could it get to this point? And I think, we were all wondering the future of everything at the time. And, you know, I think that it kind of drove some people a little bit off the edge. And I don't mean that crazy, but, you know, to a point, I was pissed off. I was pissed off for months, you know, about some of the things that were going on, and still am with some of the banks, as we all are, I think, you know, looking back on it. So, yeah, I don't blame them too much. Well, my friend John, I don't want to take any more of your time. I know you got lots of things to do, and we enjoy your work all the time. Options Monster, the place to get to go to find not only great commentary from great writers and insight into options, because one of the things you often see is when there's a big play coming, the options are the first to get the hit because the play is leveraged very heavily. And they have those things. They have an option screener and a bit of a heat map, a little product for people that use their services. And, of course, not to mention, you want to check out the Options Monster Conference. Invest like a monster in June in Chicago. Check it out. We'll put the links on the Disciplined Investor. John Nazarian, you're a good friend and a great guest. I appreciate your time.
Appreciate it as well, Andrew. Have a great day and enjoy, everybody. Look forward to seeing you at one of the events.
Well, that's John Nazarian. You got to love that guy. He's just so clear, concise. He has a almost a laser beam approach to when it comes to the markets and understanding. He's got such a great mind. You know, one of these guys that just knows a lot about individual positions and can keep a lot of that in your head. That's a very big talent, I think. It's something that takes a lot of time to really to hone and to perfect, because I don't think I've ever talked to him about a stock that he doesn't know a lot of the details on, the price points, the fundamentals about it, the management insight, the competition. I mean, it's really an impressive guy. I do encourage you to check out the Options Monster platform. Of course, they don't sponsor this or anything like that, but just, you know, I think it's a great tool to look at, as well as the fact that they have some great commentary and some excellent writers, some of the best in the business. And on top of that, if you want to learn a lot more, just check out that conference. So before we got to our discussion with John, I mentioned that we were going to have a question. Now, this one came in, and it sparked my attention. And by the way, if you want to write to me, it's askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Just simply write to that address, and we'll do our best to see if we can get something on, you know, on the air. We'll try to get the more interesting ones. But oftentimes, I do reply, and I do reply to most of, if not all, of my emails. Again, askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So this one is from Demarius. And Demarius says, he says, "Hey, Andrew, I actually went back and listened to podcast 148 with Harry Dent. And there seems to be a ton of truth in his evaluation of our current economic situation. I started listening to your podcast in 2007, and I listened to that podcast that Mr. Dent was on. And the podcast is the sole reason I pulled my money out of the market in December 28th of 2007. Thanks." That's pretty cool. "My concern today, however, is that the ever-growing debt this country is accumulating, and I don't believe it will ever get balanced out, and I believe we are headed to our own currency crisis, and it's almost unavoidable. I'm hoping that I'm wrong, but hope won't fix the situation, and only less government spending will, and I don't see that happening in the foreseeable future. What are your thoughts?" You know, I think that in the long line of country problems, Demarius, I think the problems are going to eventually hit us here. And I do believe that a lot of things that Harry Dent recently wrote in his Great Depression Ahead book, by the way, great book if you haven't read it, The Great Depression Ahead, I think a lot of that is built on the fact that we not only have an economic and a macroeconomic situation and a demographic economic situation in the United States that is not positively charged for growth, like you see in Brazil, India, South Korea, and some of the other emerging nations around the world, India, which I may have just mentioned, and China, clearly. The problem is the aging population countries like Europe and particularly in the United States, they're really the way they do business and what their GDP is made up of is no longer things that can be sustained. The high level of debt, the Keynesian style of fighting any of these problems with throwing more money at the market, more money into the industry, extending unemployment benefits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is not really the way to do it. And you know how we know that? We know that by the 3.0% print on GDP this week that was terribly disappointing when coming out of such a very significant recessionary, the Great Recession, on the verge of the second depression in history in the United States. Well, in these decades, recent history. It should have been more like 5% or 6% like we saw last quarter. But we are seeing moderate, mediocre, at best, growth on a GDP level. That's not good. Now, when you add to that the fact that the growing and blossoming and blooming and exploding debt ratios here, it's a tremendous problem that will hold us back for many years. That doesn't mean that there aren't opportunities for investments. We're talking about two separate, different, and distinct situations. We're talking about the economics on one hand. We're talking about investments on the other. But to focus on your discussion is more of an economic discussion. I think that we're probably the strongest of the worst, or the strongest of the best, however you want to look at it. We are the strongest country when it comes to the countries that are having difficulties with their deficit control. So right now, that's why it's still one of the safest bets, and where you see the flight to safety is into U.S. assets. At the same time, though, I think you have to consider that when we look at the overall environment, there is going to be some very hard decisions that will be made to cut back spending on the governmental level, and then on how much actual stimulus can be put back into the economy and how much rescue can be placed to the backing of the banks and other industries that are having problems. I mean, we know that Bernanke said basically that this is an all-in move way back a year ago, that interest rates at zero, putting the balance sheet, the Fed's balance sheet, at trillions of dollars, and increasing the budget, the deficit and our debt levels to such an enormous amount of money is pretty much an all-in move. Now, if you're playing poker, after an all-in move, when you lose that move, you cannot go back to the bucket and grab more money, forgetting about buy-ins in the early rounds. We're talking about regular poker here. When you're all in, that's it. Game over if it doesn't work. Question is, my friend Demarius, do you believe that the stimulus over the recent time here that has happened, the money that's been committed, the low interest rates, and the world environment is one that's going to collapse the dollar? Right now, we're not seeing that. Gold is moving higher, but the dollar is moving higher too. So consider the fact, in my opinion, that the U.S. right now, until further notice, is the safer bets of the plays overall. Peter Schiff would probably disagree with me entirely. He's been right on gold. He's been wrong on the dollar. Now, he'll give you some kind of discussion. We got to get him back, by the way, on the show. I'll work on that. But when you look at the environment right now, the flight to safety has clearly benefited the U.S. So there's a lot of things going on in that discussion, Demarius. I appreciate the question. I think it's something that needs to be answered. And you know what? We'll also get Harry Dent back on the show as well. A lot of things that he has talked about is coming to fruition. I think we both agree, and I've been reading some of his recent emails to me about some of his recent ideas on the summertime. And I pretty much am in lockstep with him that we may see a bit of a rally, at least a relief rally right now into the end of the summer. And then if we continue seeing some negative sentiment tape reads on the economics and the world doesn't get their act together pretty soon and give us some clarity, that we could see another dip down, maybe for the economies around the world, clearly in Europe, and at the same time, a little bit of softening in the market. So you got to be prepared for that. All right, with that, we're going to close on that happy note. On that uplifting happy note, we're going to close the show today. I want to thank you for joining me as always. Have a great, great week. And if you have any questions, do me a favor, send them in. And if you have any people that we should be interviewing, send them in to me. The ideas, just email to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll speak to you soon. Have a great week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.